Yeah, I think we all have kind of this urge for a life a little less ordinary. There's a conversation that I had with Ryan Holiday, actually. We were driving back from San Antonio one day, and I was being pretty successful. You know, I was doing a lot in the digital marketing. I was working with amazing people like yourself and some other guys. And I remember Ryan kind of looked over. He's like, "So, like, what's your thing?" And I was like, "What do you mean, what's my thing?" He's like, "You're good at a lot of things, but like, what is your thing?" I was working with like all of these amazingly creative people, and I could see them like being able to express themselves fully through some type of medium, whether that was photography or videography or these different things. And I was kind of like the guy behind the guy for a very long time. I was like, I don't know. And it seemed like I had that strong desire to have a creative outlet of some type. I think a lot of people feel that, you know, they feel like I'm a creative person. I just haven't found my outlet quite yet. I was looking for that thing to kind of, again, sink my teeth into and give my all to.
Hey, everybody, what's up? It's Chase. Welcome to another episode of show. You just heard from my friend, Brent Underwood. And what you did not know is this is the first ever episode of any podcast in the world recorded from, I believe, from 900 feet underground. Now, to be fair, I'm not 900 feet underground, but Brent Underwood was. And why he's 900 feet underground is because he is recording this show today from a ghost town. That's right. Brent purchased a ghost town, an 1865 mining town called Cerro Gordo. It's up near Mount Whitney, northeast of Los Angeles. And this story is absolutely incredible. Brent, very successful marketing executive, creative superpower, very close collaborator with a dear friend of ours, Ryan Holiday, who you know. And it left it all to go. He purchased this abandoned town and is in the process of rebuilding it. Now, today's episode is a spiritual journey. It is a creative journey. It's a personal journey through all kinds of triumph, including a fire that burned everything down partway through this restoration of this town. And there's a lot of twists and turns that if you are interested in shaking things up in your life, you have creative ambition, entrepreneurial ambition, it's an amazing show. Again, I have the good fortune of have known Brent for a long time. Today is a reconnection of sorts. We haven't been in touch for some time, and it's around this just beautiful journey that Brent is on. I can't wait to share it with you. Yours truly, Brent Underwood, Ghost Town Living. Enjoy the show. My man, Brent is in the house. Welcome. You are in a very strange place, my friend. Tell
yes.
us a little bit about where are you right now?
It is good to see you, Chase. I'm actually 900 feet underground. I was just saying, this is a first. We just ran internet 900 feet down into the abandoned mine. And I'm sitting down here a little cold, but feeling pretty comfy down here.
For the people who are listening and not watching the show, Brent is in a cave. And there's like literally, I don't know, granite on all sides of him. And he's got a nice, you're well lit, by the way, for being 900 feet underground. He's stocking cap, a couple extra layers. Mm-hmm. And the reason he is broadcasting from this location is because he lives in a ghost town, an abandoned mining town. And I've had the good fortune of knowing you for a number of years. And you, at some point, you went away and did a bold, beautiful thing. And I'm hoping you can just orient those folks at home who may not be familiar with you or your work. What in the hell are you doing?
Well, right now I'm hoping to bring a dead town back to life. That's the overarching goal. I guess more specifically right now I'm in a mining town from the 1800s, 1865, a town called Cerro Gordo was established. It was a boom town until about 1930. There's about 4,000 residents up here at its peak. They pulled about $500 million worth of silver out of the mountain, right from these tunnels that I'm sitting in right now. And I bought this. I am here because in 2018, I bought the place with a friend of mine, a couple of friends that you know as well. And I have since, in March of 2020, when the pandemic hit, people were looking, hey, where am I going to socially distance? Where am I going to do everything? And so I moved up here, thinking, hey, I'd be up here for a week or two. We'd wait this pandemic thing out. I'd be all good. And 4 years later, I'm living. I actually slept down here in the mine last night. So I am living 900 feet underground, and we're all in. We're all in on it.
Wow. Here's the follow-up question. why? What the fuck are you doing?
Yeah, why is a good question. I think there's always like, there's always the why than the real why. I think JP Morgan said there's always the reason and the real reason. The reason is that I love kind of like history and hospitality. You know, I've always loved history growing up. I went to school for real estate and finance. And then somehow I found myself working in the book world. I worked with a lot of authors. That's how we got to know each other, through Ryan Holiday. Mm-hmm. So I worked in marketing online. And so this seemed like a way to combine that love of history, of hospitality, as well as some marketing, kind of combine it all together. I think really what I was looking for was that it, what you said before, you know, like what is the thing that I'm going to give my all to, you know, something that not just like captures your attention for a minute, but what like holds your attention for a long time, that thing that like you find purpose and meaning in. And I think that I looked at for that for a very long time. I remember pretty clearly there was a conversation that I had with Ryan Holiday. Actually, we were driving back from San Antonio one day, must've been 6 years ago. And I was being pretty successful. You know, I was doing a lot in the digital marketing. I was working with amazing people like yourself and some other guys. And I remember Ryan kind of looked over. He's like, "So, like, what's your thing?" And I was like, "What do you mean, what's my thing?" He's like, "You're good at a lot of things, but like, what is your thing?" You know, because everybody eventually kind of gets segmented into their thing. Like Ryan's the stoicism guy, you know? And so like, I was like, I don't know. I like history. I like buildings. I like, you know, these different things. And it wasn't for a couple of years until I found Cerro Gordo. But I think that for the longest time, I was looking for that thing to kind of, again, sink my teeth into and give my all to. And I think it came to me as a text message from my friend that sent me a link that said, "Hey, buy your own town for under $1 million," which is an amazing headline for an article. I got to give it to whoever crafted that. I was like, I'm in. And so I clicked on it and I came out here a couple days later. And I thought, hey, this is a pretty cool town. This could be an adventure of a lifetime. And then it's been that and a lot more.
There's so many things to unpack there. I don't even know where to start. We need like 12 days, let alone an hour. But I've got a couple of ways in that I want to sort of set the table for the rest of our conversation. And then we can pick and choose. Because one of them is, I think it's really cool that you have chosen to, in the work prior to the work you're doing now, surround yourself with people who are willing to ask you the question that Ryan asked, right? What's your thing? And, you know, again, you indicated and mentioned that we've been in the same friend circle for a long time. And for someone who's listening, I think this is a really important takeaway that it's easy to dismiss, that we have friends who are going to send us this link. We have friends, we put ourselves in a group of people who are, you know, both crazy enough and bold enough to do something like that you're doing right now. So first and foremost, shout out to you. Second, for people listening at home, like, do what you can to surround yourself with people who are going to ask what's your thing, even though you're very successful on every, you know, traditional measure. You got all kinds of great work, hanging around good people, doing good stuff, living in a cool place. Check, 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 check. But there's a friend who's like, there's something more when I look at you. So, you know, again, you for hearing that call and, you know, walking on your path. So I think that's an important flag. And then there's this, an acknowledgement that you were doing something that worked just fine, but it wasn't this thing, right? It wasn't a thing. It wasn't something that you were hanging your hat on. So what was it like to come to terms with that? People think about like, hey, this is like, I've been wanting to do this since I was 8. I don't think you wanted to do this when you were 8, but something like spoke to you. That's like, you know, no more playing it safe, dude. You got to take a fucking leap.
I think we all have kind of this urge for a life a little less ordinary. And I think that I surrounded myself with a lot of creative people. To your point, through Ryan, I was able to be around, you know, like really heavyweights in the author world. I was working with Tim Ferriss, Robert Greene, you know, I was working with like all of these amazingly creative people, and I could see them like being able to express themselves fully through some type of medium, whether that was photography or videography or these different things. And I was kind of like the guy behind the guy for a very long time. I was sitting like front row as Ryan became a heavyweight in the kind of author world. And it seemed like I had that strong desire to have a creative outlet of some type. I think a lot of people feel that, you know, they feel like, I'm a creative person. I just haven't found my outlet quite yet. And so for a couple of years, I was always thinking, you know, what's going to be my outlet? And I think when Ryan asked me that, it kind of brought it to the forefront. I was like, okay, am I going to, you know, start a newsletter about productivity, you know, which a lot of people do, or am I going to do, you know, what am I, what is the thing going to be? And when I started thinking about like what my true passions were, you know, I thought a lot about Robert Greene. Robert Greene always says, hey, you know, mastery comes when you take unique skill sets and combine them in a unique way. And I thought, what am I good at? I'm good at, you know, hospitality at that point. I'm good at marketing. I'm good at, you know, storytelling was a big part of it.
I was just going to put that in your yeah. mouth. If you didn't, that's, you're so good at that.
Storytelling was a big part of it. And so when this kind of came to me, I was like, the trappings were there for it to be the thing, right? That it was like, okay, this is actually what I'm thinking about. To your point, I had a very comfortable life. I was living in Austin. I had an amazing apartment. I had a great friend circle. I was on paper working with everybody that I ever wanted to work with. But then I was like, but what am I doing? You know, I know there's a little bit more there. And so I think when I saw it, it was like, oh, kind of like the light bulb went on a little bit. And it's scary too, because I was like, this is going to be like a pretty serious thing. And then I don't think it fully developed into the thing until after living up here for a little bit of time. I think the context of understanding the space made it, you know, made me fall in love with it a lot more. But I think it all stemmed from this understanding that there was a creative force within me that wasn't being expressed very well. And maybe this could be a beautiful canvas to do that within, you know, why not like an old town? And since moving up here, I've definitely got to quote unquote paint quite a bit. It's been fun.
So let's tell people where up here is, first of all. Go ahead.
I'm in Cerro Gordo, which is about 3 hours outside of Los Angeles. It's about 3 hours from Death Valley. If people are familiar with where Mount Whitney is, I'm actually directly across the valley from Mount Whitney, which is out towards Mammoth Lakes, if people know where Mammoth Lakes is. So imagine about 200 miles northeast of Los Angeles in the mountains.
3 hours into the mountains, if you drove northeast, you can't not hit your town. Okay.
And people think about ghost towns, they think about a desert a lot of times. I'm actually up in the mountains. We're at 8,500 feet in elevation. So if I were to leave the mine that I'm in and go outside, there's about 5 feet of snow on the ground right now. So it's pretty mountainous up here.
Yeah. And what people, I mean, would you consider, it's mountainous, but does it have a high desert feel to it?
Yeah, it's definitely the high desert. It's very sparse in trees. Yeah. There's Joshua trees up here. You know, there's cactus. There's a couple of pinyon pines, but it's not like a forest with trees. Imagine a very sparse terrain, yet really high up in elevation.
Yeah, Death Valley.
Correct. Yeah, we're 6 miles from Death Valley. So we're right on the border of Death Valley.
There you go. Okay, so you've painted that picture. And the idea of this canvas that you are painting and being a storyteller. So someone who's listening to this, who they're saying, okay, dude dropped everything and moved to the middle of nowhere. What sort of infrastructure is where you are? What sort of, you know, and to be fair, this is all incredibly well chronicled in your new book, which is, I'm holding. Thank you for sending me an advanced copy. It's called Ghost Town Living, Mining for Purpose and Chasing Dreams on the Edge of Death Valley, at the Edge of Death Valley. So insane. And you started telling stories before the book years ago on a YouTube channel that now has like 1.5 million subs or something.
About that. Yeah. It was that desire to do something creative. I remember when I moved out here for the pandemic, I thought I wanted to get into astrophotography. That was the whole origin of all the YouTube is I thought we're in a dark sky up here. There's no light pollution anywhere. To get to your infrastructure, I'll touch on that first. There's no running water up here. There hasn't been running water up here for 150 years. We are on the power grids. So we have power, luckily. When I first moved here, there was no internet. I was using a hotspot from an AT&T. So it was very primitive. There's no central heat. You know, we're burning wood to keep warm. The final 8 miles to get to town is a dirt road that increases a mile in elevation during that 8 miles. So it's a steep, mountainous dirt road that gets snowed in. And so we're remote. Even at the bottom of the town, the closest town to us is a town called Lone Pine, which has a population of about 1,000. The closest Home Depot is probably 2 hours away. You know, the closest Walmart, the same, 2 hours away. So it's not like I'm taking daily runs down to the hardware store or anything for any of these projects. It's quite quite remote and quite primitive.
That is very helpful you're continuing to paint the picture, but let's anchor just for a moment further on is there a distinction between the project that you are doing with this town and your life? Like, they seem the same, which I think this pickles the brain of a lot of people who are sitting in a comfy car in traffic on the way to a job or on the jogging path right now between, you know, work and going home to the family. And I want to be clear, it doesn't require that you do what Brent is doing, but how do you make a distinction between the life that you're living and the project, or is your life the project?
They've kind of become one at this point. You know, I tried for 2 years to keep them separate. We bought the property in 2018 and I didn't move out here until 2020. And initially it's one of those projects where I thought we could do it from afar. You know, it's very popular to talk about outsourcing these days, like, oh, I could outsource it. We could do this. But especially with the physical space, you need to be here. And so after moving here, I just fell more and more in love with it. I felt less connected to what was in Austin. And at this point, yeah, I think the project, my life, any creativity there within is all kind of merged into one. And at this point, I feel lucky that the life that I'm allowed to live up here is interesting enough to be some of the creative output by itself, you know, just the existence being up here. Obviously, within that, there's a million little things that I'm doing. But yeah, at this point, they're kind of one and the same.
It's very seductive. And at the same, I think it terrifies a lot of folks who are maybe believe that is required to tap into this creativity that, you know, you're experiencing at a deep level. Do you think that's true? And I'm curious, you know, expand on that. Why not?
I don't think it's true. I mean, I've sat front row to where Ryan is my closest counterpoint that I can look to. And Ryan has a very full life outside of his work. You know, he's one that's able to be extraordinarily creative on every medium, from video to written to all these different things, but still have a very robust family. You know, he has kids that he starts hanging out with at 3 o'clock every day, you know, so he's not fully all into it. For me, it's a little bit different circumstance. I'm just kind of all into it. I could see a point of pulling back and kind of reflecting on the pine here. I don't think it's necessarily healthy to be 4 years all day, every day into it in the way that I am. So I know it can be balanced because I've seen it firsthand with Ryan.
Well, what's a day like? Like, let's just get real here, because I think you're talking about no running water and no, you know, and I had to let that sit there for the last like 8 minutes. But right now I'm thinking, holy smokes. You know, I go up to our beach place where I have to turn the water on. I have to get under the house and turn the water on. And that's inconvenient.
So
what's the day-to-day like? And talk to us about some of the projects that you're doing.
Yeah, when I first moved in, no running water. So imagine outhouses. So during the winter, you're trudging through snow, maybe up to your waist, to get to an outhouse where the wind's going to be whipping in from underneath. You're going to get really cold while going to the bathroom. You can return to your house, hopefully wash your hands with some hand sanitizer or maybe a gallon jug of water. Since I made a little bit of improvements, we now truck up water and put it in storage tanks. And so I got gifted a old 5-ton military truck, this huge old military truck that we pull up about 1,000 gallons at a time up the dirt road. So that goes into storage tanks. Those storage tanks feed two buildings here now have running water. So the two buildings, have most of the time, unless it gets too cold. So for me, the daily life, I wake up, you know, the first thing in the winter is to get the fire going. There's no central heat. So to break that morning cold is very important. So that's, you know, stoking the fire a little bit, get it warm, maybe get a tea or something a little bit nice. Check in online. These days we do have internet, which is nice. So I kind of do my day job. I check in, see everything's going on. And then I'll go into the projects. And I think there's about 4 or 5 big projects we're working on at the moment in the town. We're rebuilding a hotel here. So we're building basically a commercial hotel from scratch in the middle of nowhere, which has been very difficult. We just put the roof on it. And so we're working on the electrical and plumbing inside during the winter. So that way we can stay out of the snow and all that type of stuff. And so it's bouncing between either the hotel. Right now I'm at the 900-foot level of the mine because I'm building out like a little, I'm going to call it a suite down here, like a room, because it's actually, although it's cold down here, it's about 25 degrees warmer than it is in town down here at the 900 foot level. And so I can actually like do things down in the mines. We're in town right now. There's so much snow, I can't do that much. Mm-hmm. And so working on this little project down here, we're building out a recording studio in one of the old cabins. So we have a cabin from the 1800s that we're turning into a recording studio. I milled some wood from scratch to put up on the walls and the floors and all that. So we're working on that. And yeah, there's always a hundred other smaller projects there within, you know, that we're fixing up when you have 20 buildings from the 1800s that always need constant maintenance. There's a bunch of different things going on.
So this is going to be the spot to record. All these rock stars from LA are going to come up and come live in your mine and get this crazy ass experience and then record in the old building from the 1800s that you milled wood with your bare hands to build.
I hope so. You know, there's a lot of inspiration here. I hope that people get to tap into the inspiration. From the studio, you overlook all the Sierra Nevada. So you see Mount Whitney and you see Owens Valley and you just see this stunning view. And so hopefully, yeah, people come up and they draw a little inspiration from it.
There's a part in the book, again, for the title for folks who, this is a must. First of all, sub to the YouTube channel and the book is a must. Ghost Town Living, Mining for Purpose and Chasing Dreams at the Edge of Death Valley. There's a part in here called Be Your Own Light that, you know, as I think to the most difficult times in my life where you're sort of looking out there, it's almost always true that it's showed up in here. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you can, you know, provide a little bit of context for both the book and your, you know, what you mean by Be Your Own Light, with the goal of helping other people see. It doesn't even have to be it's not a map, right? It's more of a compass. Help us understand.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's stemming from a quote or a story about Buddha. I guess on Buddha's deathbed, his followers came to him and they're like, what are we supposed to do now that you're dying? And he just said, be your own light. Basically, you know, find inspiration within yourself or kind of like draw that out of you to continue guiding yourself. And it came to me after a pretty difficult moment where about 4 years ago, we had a fire up here that burned down the hotel that we're now rebuilding. And after that, it was very dark, you know, it was very dark mentally and emotionally and all this kind of, that was our crown jewel. We were building all the plans around this one hotel and it was gone. And then it was kind of like, what are we going to do now? And that's actually when I started making a lot of the YouTube videos. And so it was kind of like documenting the process and showing the struggles and the inspiration and the perseverance throughout it. And people found it inspiring, I guess. They found it interesting. And so a lot of people started like being drawn to it, drawn to the light, I guess, and just this enthusiasm towards the project. And from that, so many doors unlocked. You know, the rebuilding of this hotel, I don't know, would have been possible without social media, which is a very interesting thing to say. You know, I think that in this day and age, it's very easy to be like, you know, social media, the destructive nature of it. But up here, YouTube's literally rebuilding a town from scratch in a way. And so that's pretty cool. And so I think as I started putting some of that stuff out, and you know, like for me, it was very cathartic in some way to share the experience. It was scary too. Like I wasn't, again, I was always the guy behind the guy. And so putting very vulnerable moments out there were scary, but it brought back so much more than it took to put it out there, I guess.
This is the post-hotel world is one of the reasons that New York Times says Underwood's story continues to be of endless fascination.
Yes.
Vice says it is a romantic way of life, but it hasn't been without its share of difficulties, worries, and setbacks. So when you think of these worries and setbacks, one of the things that I know to be true about myself is there's a tension between a desire for comfort, right? This is like the reason you create a fire, you make a fire when you wake up in the morning is you want to be comfortable because it's cold as shit. If you're not making that fire, it's very uncomfortable. And yet you've just put yourself in the middle of an ocean of discomfort. So how much of that was willing and intentional and how much of that is an, oh shit, what have I done?
Yeah, I would say the beginning, like impetus to come out here in 2020 was definitely looking for an adventure. You know, I thought, hey, the pandemic's going to be an interesting time in a lot of people's lives. what better place to go than this old town? And so I was in the market, let's say, for some discomfort, for a different way of living, to shake up that kind of like uniformity that I found myself falling into in Austin. Within that, a lot of it was not desired or planned or kind of like ready. We've dealt with, we had a fire, we have had earthquake, we had a floods, two floods now. We've had all these different things that really kind of tested it. And so the initial desire was to experience something that wasn't as comfortable as Austin, you know, was to shake me to my core almost. I got very shooken and continue to get shaken, I think, month over month here. But I think that like as you go through those little shakes, like each one feels less intense, right? The first year I was here, everything felt like a crisis in some way. You know, even the smallest thing, it was a crisis. Oh my God, compared to Austin, how are we going to do? How could we possibly get, you know, these supplies up here? Now it just kind of, it's like a muscle, right? It's developed and I feel a lot more comfortable in uncomfortable situations, which I think is a important place to be.
Let's go specifically to the place you are in right now, because I can't, again, for the folks who are listening, you know, I hate to reference the visual that you do not get right now, but let me paint a picture. Like, again, Brent, I see the circle of his face with beanie pulled down over his ears, you know, red beard, hoodie times two. He's got a hoodie and another jacket with a hood, and there's, you're well lit, but yeah, you are literally in a cave. And I'm guessing that there is a lot of space behind the camera, but it looks like you were, you know, tucked in a little coyote cave that's not much taller than your head. And it is just an extraordinary place to share about your story. But in a way, like that's what you're living. Now, is that drama for drama's sake, or is this really, is this the level of hardness or harshness or barrenness of the landscape and the experience that you're having right now? Because you'd have to, this is a baller move to go live in a cave. Yeah, I mean, it's, I'm looking at it and it's like, I expect you to have trapped a bobcat and, you know, gnawing on a drumstick of, you know, coyote thigh or something right now.
it's a couple of things. I think first it was going into the mines was a beginning of trying to, a quest for understanding, right? So the whole town exists because of what happened down in the mines. And so for me, I think anytime you provide more context to your experience, this experience means more. Like if you were to walk by a park every day of your life for your whole life, but one day you stop and you decide to look up the history of that park's going to mean so much more to you every time you walk by that park from there on. Mm-hmm. And so I think during my time here at Cerro Gordo, I've tried to understand what the history books were talking about. And so that inevitably leads you down into the mines. The town exists because of the mines. And the mines are crazy. There's 30 miles of mines down here. There's break rooms down here. There's dynamite vaults down here. There's just an infinite amount of space. And so for me, it was over the time, it was a reason to come down here and explore, learn more about the town. But these days, I also, there is the factor of, I just think it's cool, right? It's like interesting to be down here. Like part of the reason I'm down here is I recorded my audiobook down here for the book. And so I'll pan the camera so you can see, like, that's my kind of like audiobook setup over there. I don't know if you see the candles. It's kind of just,
it is like romantic as hell what I'm looking at right now. I see the camera. I see, yeah, another camera over there. You're like,
yeah. And so it's been a journey, but there's also like, the book touches on a lot of the history of Cerro Gordo and the history.
Yeah, it opens with the mining and the prospector. Yeah. And yeah, I think it's fascinating.
And so to get myself in that headspace, I think to be down here is like an interesting space to narrate it, and it's an interesting space to be often. I do find like inspiration down here. There's like right behind me too, there's carbide graffiti on the wall where miners were writing their name in the 1800s. And it's like, it's interesting to see it, but it's also like that person was writing their name for some reason, right? They wanted to be remembered in some way. And I think we all want to be remembered in some way. That drives a lot of different creative outlets, I think, in some different manners. And so those thoughts get sparked as I'm wandering through the mines and I'm looking at what was left behind and what wasn't left behind. And it's just another place to draw inspiration from than upstairs, I guess, or upstairs. I'll show you how I get down here too. Just again, I don't want to belabor the visual.
No, I, this,
That's the elevator to get up and down.
Wow. Come on, dude. I'm telling you right now, if you're listening, 99% of the people listening do not want to get in that elevator.
No.
Or elevator, let alone go 900 feet.
Elevator is a generous interpretation of what is actually a cage hoisted by a steel cable that lets you down here.
How are you, like, is the community that supports this dream that you're on, that watches you on YouTube and social media, and is that what's sustaining and creating your ability to invest in the buildings and the hotel, and, you know, is the books that we buy, is that contributing to your ability to live this dream?
Yeah, it's a lot of it. I think, you know, abandoned mining towns are money pits, to lack of a better word. They will take any amount of money you could ever put into them. But the social media stuff helps pay a lot of the bills. That all goes right back into the town, whether it's rebuilding the hotel and stuff like that. But I still do my day job. You know, Ryan and I still have the company. And so that's still what helps supplement the bills too. Luckily, yeah. I can do that from anywhere, even 900 feet underground. And so, but the support of the social media is what is bringing this town back to life. And again, I think that's what, it's so cool. Like over the past 4 years, we've had over 2,000 volunteers come up and help for the day or for a couple of days or for the week, just because they want to be part of rebuilding something. You know, they just have that shared interest, and the story has captivated them enough to come and spend their extra days hammering in some nails, you know, and just doing what they can. And that's been, it's been really cool.
I built houses in the summers during college, so I'm not decent with a hammer. You might get a few hours out of me the next time.
Come on, dude.
I might come just to do a little work, and it is really truly remarkable. But what is keeping you from throwing in the towel? Are you all in now? I mean, like, it sounds exciting for me because I get to do it for a weekend. If I go down there to hang out, it's going to be like, cool, give me some jobs to do and I want to contribute. And don't get me wrong, that's meaningful, but you don't have that luxury. You have really sort of, there's not too many, I mean, I think you can walk back through that door to be fair. You could just like sell it. You bought an asset. I've improved it. You know, whether you can sell it for more than you bought it for or the same, like there is a way out, but it doesn't occur to me that you're at the end of anything. You're at the beginning of something.
Yeah, I'm all in, I think, financially, emotionally, spiritually. And I think that there's a lot of comfort in that. I think that there's comfort and commitment. I think it kind of goes against what I had been growing up with my whole life. And I think that's why I find so much satisfaction here. I think within entrepreneurship, within a lot of things, it's always kind of going from thing to thing to thing. Like even right now, what are they calling it? Like the great quitting, like everybody's
resignation.
The great resignation, where people are all quitting because they're unhappy. And so if you can find that project where you can actually settle in and see yourself, hey, I'm going to work on this for the rest of my life. I think there's a lot of comfort in that. I used to get a lot of anxiety of thinking, okay, I'm doing these small projects, but what's the next project? What's the next project? I think a lot of creative people think that, like, what's the next project? You know? But here, I know what the next project is for hopefully the rest of my life. And so within that, you have little micro projects, obviously. But I think I personally have found a huge amount of comfort just knowing that Cerro Gordo is it, that I'm all in on this thing, that I'm going to be focusing on this hopefully till the day I die. Maybe they'll bury me in the cemetery here when I'm done. But for me, there's just been, it's removed that anxiety of what's next, what's next, what's next. And I think that that's something that came to me after being here. It wasn't something necessarily that I set out to do from the very beginning, but I found a lot of, again, like comfort in that.
Is it fair to say comfort is a generous word for it?
Yeah. Emotional comfort, not physical comfort, maybe. Yes.
I'm taking a note here for something else I want to come back to. There's you keep saying we. You got like 50 people living out there. You got a whole work crew. Like what? You keep saying we. Tell us who we is.
Yeah, we is the community is what I usually try to give the generous interpretation to, because there's been a lot of people that have helped bring this thing back to life so far, from the volunteers to everybody else, the people that watch on YouTube. But living here full time it's me and I have a full-time town manager. The guy's named Steven right now, and he helps kind of coordinate the volunteers coming. And we usually have at least a volunteer or two here most days. And so when I say we, I'm referring to me and Steven, but also me and the other volunteers and me and the community of people online, just because it's not, no one person is going to rebuild a town from scratch ever. And so it's definitely going to be a group effort. But the picture day to day is just myself, Steven, a couple volunteers usually, and then visitors. We have probably a dozen or so visitors that come and check it out during the better months of the year.
Let's look at the flip side of this romantic experience that you're living. You've told a lot of beautiful tales, and I think the media have celebrated it. And your book is very, you've done a very, very good job of telling both sides of the story, right? It is romantic, and there is, you have been clear about just, well, just as you just said, like there's a, you used to have a lot of anxiety, and now there's sort of a comfort. And yet, it's hard. The book is very clear about that. There's talk to me about the chapter called Burnout, for example. Like, I'm wondering if you can shed some light on that. While you've come alive in choosing to do a thing, the thing is not without hardship, peril. You know, do a little bit of storytelling around that idea.
Totally. I mean, I wish the thing was a tropical island with infinite water. You know, I feel like that would be a little bit better thing to have found as my thing. And so, I mean, even the day-to-day, I guess there's two aspects of it. There's the practical aspects, then there's kind of the more esoteric or emotional aspects that are both difficult. And the practical is, you know, groceries are hard, no running water is hard, internet is hard some days. We actually just got power back 2 days ago. We were on generators for 7 days because this atmospheric river, you know, that came through knocked out our power and brought a blizzard. And so everything, even baseline comfort, what you're talking about, is difficult to get to. I can't just turn the thermostat and set it at 70 degrees. I have to get the fire going for a good hour before we're going to even be in a comfortable level. And so there's this baseline discomfort. There's also the emotional discomfort. It is very lonely, you know, living in the middle of nowhere. I used to be a very social person with a huge social crew. We would bump into people in the streets that I knew, you know, at a big friend group. And so I think during the pandemic, it's easy to negate that because you're like, you know, everybody's taking time away from people. We're all a little bit lonely now. So in the 2020, 2021-ish time, I thought, I'm actually living the best life. I have, you know, all this room to explore. We have 400 acres here surrounded by millions of acres of national parks and stuff. So everybody's lonely, but I also get this. And then as the world eased up a little bit socially and everybody's hanging out again, I'm like, oh, but now what?
And so any more volunteers? Do we have any more?
Yeah. Anybody want to come up for the weekend? Anybody want to hang out? Anybody want to bring a volleyball? Please. And so I think it's been, but the trade-offs are worthwhile. You know, I do find that purpose here, and I have gone back to Austin and places, and I do hang out with my friends. But every time I'm there, I'm drawn back here because the work's not done. You know, like we talked about, I am all in on this thing, and I do see it as the thing I want to do more than anything. And so the trade-off for me at the moment is still very much worth it being out here day to day. I think I could foresee myself in the future getting to a place where I'm not here full time. I could see myself skipping a couple winters, you know, this winter's been kind of, I mean, you can see my breath probably down here in the mine. So it's a little cold down here, but, it's difficult day to day. It's difficult emotionally. It's difficult when these big tragedies happen to kind of pull yourself up by the bootstraps and keep going like time and time and time again. Cause again, this isn't how I make my living. This is actually how I spend the money that I get while making my living. And so it's not a financial incentive to be here at the moment. Mm. It's something deeper than that. But yeah. I think that it is filling a void that I wasn't getting in Austin with my day-to-day job. And so for now, that trade-off seems worthwhile.
I love your transparency on that because, you know, early on in our broadcast here, our recording, and I think from a distance, it might seem like, oh, well, that's really easy for Brent to do that because, you know, he's got 1.5 million social followers and can get, you know, $X thousand a month from his YouTube videos. And so, you know, but to know that there's, I think that keeps a lot of people stuck. It keeps a lot of people from taking, you know, the leap because they believe that they've got to like burn the boats and they've got to, you know, most people think, oh, the entrepreneur only, you know, mortgage your house and you're all, you know, put everything on red and spin the dial. And yeah, I remember having a very clear conversation with Richard Branson. He's like, look, one of the things that, why, one of the reasons I have 400 companies is because I protected the downside. Mm-hmm. And you're the fact that you are maintaining a job. And actually there's a weird, beautiful, like I'm working remote.
Yeah, like it's very remote.
Really, really remote.
Yes.
But I'm wondering if you can add any color to that, like that you do have a day job and that it doesn't make you any less committed or any less, like, you know, would you leave that day job if you could, if you suddenly had, you know, someone backed a dump truck full of, you know, $5 million in the property, would you, you know, is the goal to really transition into this? And this is your, this is sort of the transition methodology. Paint a picture for us.
I think, you know, I don't know that making the leap and selling the mortgage and all that is necessarily a good idea. I think that sure. Most of the creatives that I know always have something else that, you know, they're doing to supplement it. Like Ryan, for instance, I'll go back to him. He was director of marketing at American Apparel, kept that job while he wrote Trust Me, I'm Lying, put out Trust Me, I'm Lying, then kept another, you know, always kind of had a back thing and diversified. But for me these days, I enjoy kind of switching brain modes. I think if I think about Cerro Gordo all day, every day, it just gets a lot. But when I think about a problem that we're dealing with Brass Check, then it unlocks something for Cerro Gordo too. So I actually enjoy the flipping between the two of them and the comfort that, you know, there's a paycheck coming in that isn't dependent on what I'm doing here is very, very nice. In full transparency, it's like the reason that I'm able to keep doing it. Yeah. And so, yeah, I could see myself doing both for a very long time.
Well, it's also like, it doesn't, that you just put the roof on. The roof didn't show up for free.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. These are things you got to buy.
Yeah.
Right. You're, yeah. Not only is the, you have to pay, you know, pay for the supplies. You mentioned, you know, getting volunteers and you're your own, you know, labor and sweat equity, but is the vision, let's, why don't you paint for us the midterm and long-term vision?
Yeah. I hope that midterm, we open up the hotel. It's going to have 7 rooms. It has a bar and restaurant. The bar is actually a good story. The bar is a Brunswick bar. So Brunswick made bowling alleys, but then he also made beautiful bars in the 1800s until Prohibition. And the bar came from Ryan's bookstore in Austin. Ryan bought a building from the 1800s. He didn't want the bar anymore. I flew to Austin, got the bar, drove it back to California. It's now waiting for to go into the hotel. And so the midterm goal is to open up the hotel and hopefully stabilize cash flows so the property's at least paying for itself so I don't have to keep funneling all of my money into the town. Long-term, I'd love to have more accommodation, whether that's the hotel plus cabins plus campsites. So that way, no matter what people's, you know, comfort level financially is, they have a place to stay up here and get inspiration from. I think right now, a lot of the town is based upon the social media and the content aspect of it. So I hope to keep growing that. You know, I have the YouTube, the book coming out. We're having a board game coming out this year, like a Wild West board game. That's going to be pretty fun. And so keep building that. And then I think long-term, the thing that I kind of get excited about is maybe the brand element of it. You know, if we can preserve Cerro Gordo as an interesting brand, maybe there's some interesting things to do with, say, like a whiskey company or something of that nature, where I could see it being an interesting thing. But again, within that, we have events. So we did a foot race this year up at 8 Mile Dirt Road. We had a little movie thing. So we have like the event segment. Then we have, you know, all these different little things within the big business. So that's why I said I just love painting on the canvas. And I think for people that are listening that haven't seen it, I don't know if you've seen it, Chase, but the Walt Disney, I think in the 60s, he hand drew how all of his businesses were related. It's this beautiful drawing.
It's such a cool drawing. Yeah.
So I look at that a lot, and that's kind of how I think about Cerro Gordo. There's the content arm, obviously, but then there's the physical property of the town itself, plus there's the brand. And so I'd love one day to have a map of my own, somewhat like that.
You doing all your own storytelling? You have some help? Like what's, you know, the stories are so beautiful, all of the trials and tribulations. I'd like to peel back that layer for a second, because I think the idea of doing a thing is always beautiful. And as someone who told the story about myself starting in 2004, '05, early internet, I started writing and, you know, had a full-time video person. I'm all respect to Gary Vee, but I had a full-time video person in 2005 helping me tell my story. And the notion of not just living the experience, but helping other people understand what it's like through all these different channels. Like, that's the thing that's so, I think it's so cool. And right now there's someone, I think, you know, who's interested in taking a leap, not the same leap that you've taken, but something different in their life. And I do want to encourage them to tell the stories, but what if they don't, you know, see themselves as a storyteller? What kind of advice would you give somebody who, you know, wants to tell the story, and what have you learned about it that might be helpful to them?
Yeah. I mean, I'm a naturally very reserved person. I came out here with a camera, you know, maybe thinking that we could make, that would take photos, and then maybe that led to videos. And it was just, I had a Sony A7, you know, I borrowed it from Ryan. I stole the camera I have over there, you know, 100 million views later or whatever. And so I think early on, a thing that I did that I think was pretty deliberate was I tried to inject even more personality and like my feelings towards things than I'm comfortable with. I'm naturally not sharing a lot of things. And so I didn't want people to just be fans of a guy in an old town. I wanted them to be fans of me. And I know that sounds selfish, but like, I wanted them to, like, if they're going to go on this journey, that like, I need to put 20% more of me into the video than I'm comfortable doing. And I did that pretty deliberate early on. I would sometimes watch the cuts. I'm shooting everything with a tripod and I'm doing it all myself. And then I'd be like, yeah, but why? You know, there's that saying that people don't care what you're doing, they care why you're doing it. And so I would always go back to my videos and try to insert like 20% more why I'm doing all the different things that I was doing. And one of the big kind of like pivotal videos on the channel was after the big fire we had, I was a wreck. And I shared that, you know, I shared a very vulnerable moment where like, I might've looked weak. I was like crying on camera. I was like distraught. And I think that that was very uncomfortable for me to share. I didn't want to share that, but I think that people resonated with it. You know, it just seemed kind of like, oh, this is like a real person. This isn't just somebody creating content for content's sake. And so I think early on, you know, the more you could invest, get people to invest in the why you're doing the thing, the better. And I think I did a pretty decent job early on explaining the whys of why I was doing the different things I was doing in town. And it was uncomfortable at first, but I think it's paid off in a big way.
Opening line from the book is, I am the age of most of the ghosts that live here. I know you live with a handful of cats, you get some goats, but there are clearly ghosts up there. Tell us about the ghosts.
Yeah, the town was a dangerous town back in the day. The newspapers were talking about like a murder a week in the newspapers. There's a cemetery here that has like 400 miners in it. The ghosts, I think, were more prevalent early on. So I don't know what, there's two trains of thoughts. Either one, the ghosts are becoming more comfortable with me, or two, I'm becoming more comfortable with the things I perceived as ghosts early on in my experience here. Might be a thing. But the biggest one that I ever had is, there's a building here called the Bunkhouse, and past the Bunkhouse is an overlook to overlook all of Owens Valley. And Owens Valley is what sits right below Mount Whitney. It's where Los Angeles gets its drinking water from. And so I go up there to watch the sunset, and I was walking past the Bunkhouse, and this is before I was living here full time. I remember somebody looked out of the kitchen window, closed the curtain. I didn't think too much of it, because at the time we had contractors up here occasionally helping out with different projects. So I went on my way, I watched the sunset, I came back to town. At this point, this was 2018, and we had a caretaker. And so I asked Robert, I was like, hey, Robert, you know, how long are the contractors staying in the Bunkhouse? And he looked at me, he's like, they left 2 weeks ago. I was like, all right, well, I know I saw someone in there. And so I went down to the Bunkhouse. I looked through all the rooms. No one's in there. No one's stumbling upon the town. You know, it's 8 miles up a road. So the light in the kitchen was off. I turned off the light. I padlocked the door. I went about my day. I didn't think anything of it. And then that night, I went to go watch the sunset again. And the light in the kitchen was back on. And I was like, I know I turned it off, you know, and I know that all of these things happened. And as a very rational person, I couldn't rationalize how the light could get turned back on through a locked door after seeing a person in there the night before. And so after that, My way of handling it is I just avoid the bunkhouse. I figure there's enough land up here. We can all have our space. We can cohabitate. And so I don't see them anymore. They don't see me. I let them kind of have their space and they'll have mine, I think.
What's been the biggest challenge that you didn't foresee? It seems like a lot of the things that you were saying, you're like, yeah, it's going to be hard. It's going to be cold. It's going to be difficult. Water's going to be difficult. Food's going to be difficult. It's going to be hard to get support and help and money. And like, but what was the thing you did not expect?
The hotel burning down. That was it threw everything. Cause that was that was the crown jewel of the town. Our plans are based upon that. We were going to build cabins around that and use that as kind of like the museum-ish area. And so then it was just, everything was thrown into a tailspin. And so you kind of had two options then. It was like, tuck my tail between my legs and leave, you know, go to another project or kind of continue on. And a pretty big moment was the old owner came to town and I was distraught. He came the day of the fire and he kind of put his hand on my shoulder and he goes, you know, you can't change what happened, but what happens from here is up to you. And so like that second sentence I thought about every single day for months. I was like, what happens from here is up to you. What happens from here is up to you. And so I kept thinking about that. And he's right. You know, no amount of being upset about the hotel is going to like continue the process in any way, but like what happens next was up to me. And so I kind of used that as my guiding light for the first 6 or 8 months of the rebuilding process. And that kind of got me through some of the harder times. Just when I would think about it, it's difficult not to think about a project like this in a long-term time set, you know, to think about it in decades or centuries, even when I'm reading books about this town and century. And so in 50 years, the fire of 2020 isn't going to be, you know, on my front doorstep. It's going to be part of history. And so what happens after that is going to be what's important. And so I kind of thought about that quite a bit after the fire.
How did the fire happen? Do you know?
Electrical is what it apparently started in the building next to it. And it was just, you know, 100-year-old building with 100-year-old newspaper being used for insulation with wiring that should have never been in there. And an arc happens and these things are just tinder boxes, basically.
Were you on the property when it happened?
I was myself and the old caretaker was here. And then two friends of four of us were here. And it was a really, really rough night.
You just walk out and it's burning and you're like, get the water. Oh, there's no water.
Yeah, it was 3 a.m. So it was in the middle of the night. And like what got my attention is I started hearing popping that I thought was like gunshots. I thought somebody come to town with gunshots, but it was the canned goods in the hotel getting so hot that they were exploding. And then the propane tanks doing the same thing. And so that fire was already going. And so these pops were happening. You come out and just see like your hopes and dreams. And it felt just like a nightmare is the only way to describe it. But from that, we rebuild, which has been kind of a big process of the whole thing. And so now we're about, I think this year we could hopefully open the new hotel, which will be a very exciting moment for me. So I'm hoping this year we kind of open our doors and accept people up to stay, which I think will be a really exciting moment for the whole community.
That is a big, big moment, right? You start getting it's like your first customer in business.
Yeah.
It's the first dollar that you frame, right?
Totally.
Oh man. The book is called Ghost Town Living, Mining for Purpose and Chasing Dreams at the Edge of Death Valley. Where else would you steer us besides? I mean, I've shouted out the YouTube channel a couple of times because it's extraordinary. But is that where you want us to spend our time with your world?
I'd say the Ghost Town Living on YouTube is a great place to go. I'm on TikTok too, Brent Underwood on there.
How'd you get millions of followers there, by the way? You're not doing a lot of you're not doing a lot of dancing up there.
No, it was crazy. The TikTok went from 0 to 1 million in a month. And it was just people liked the idea. This was 2022 when people were kind of glued to their phones, but yeah. I was just showing me exploring the mines. And I think something resonated. You know, you're going through a bunch of dances and then one guy's like, today we're going to go 700 feet underground and look for jeans. And they're like, what are you talking about? And so I think I found it too, like, not to belabor it, but like I found TikTok early on an interesting creative exercise of it. Can you tell a compelling story in 60 seconds? Because that's kind of the method I tried to use. And I don't know, it was fun early on.
I love what you're doing. I'm a huge fan. Congratulations on everything that you've accomplished. And as I said earlier, I think you're at the beginning of the tale, not at the middle or the end. So I'm so excited to see where this goes. And I think you somehow signed me up for a weekend of hard labor I don't know, at some point.
Come on out. Anytime. Doors always open. If you want to come and hang out. I got a bunch of toys up here. We got dirt bikes and four-wheelers and stuff. We'll go have a good time.
I like all those things. Yeah. Brent, thank you so much for being a guest on the show. From everybody out there in the world. And from 900 feet underground, you look great for being 900 feet. I think you'd be all dirty and whatnot, but you look great. You look clean. I
appreciate that. I'm a little dusty. Maybe the camera isn't showing at all. I'm pretty dusty. I slept in, this is my third day down here, so I'm feeling it a little bit, but I appreciate that. Thanks,
Jay. Awesome. Well, signing off from myself and Brent from 900 feet underground, I'm in a cozy studio in Seattle. but until next time, hopefully another show right after this one, maybe even today or tomorrow. Enjoy what it is that we're putting out there in the world. Thanks for following, and I bid you a great day. All right. Hey, before you go, thanks so much for listening. And if you got value from this show, chances are your community will too, right? In the particular lies the universal. Please share this link to the show with a friend or mention the show on social. That is a huge benefit for us and hopefully in exchange for providing value to you. I want you to know that I really appreciate your time, the attention, anything that you give to the show, and the questions that you ask our guests, either on social media or through my text community. All that is pure gold. This community, like any community, is a testament to that old phrase, a rising tide floats all boats. And by elevating one another, by sharing and resharing this show, the tidbits that you learn and the experiences you take away, all of that has a collective, massive, positive impact on the world. So, just a quick thank you. I appreciate all the effort you put into sharing for this show. All right, that's a wrap. Let's put today's episode into practice and get back to growing together.